We are about to conclude the second term of the Megillashir. And if you remember last time, we concluded the second perek. We concluded the second chapter of the Megillah. And we're going now to start the third chapter of Megillas Esther. And there's an intro in the Medrash Rabbah that discusses this. And I wanted to go through the intro with you because I think it sets the scene for the third perek perfectly. So if that's okay, we're going to do the Medrash Rabbah first and then go into the Psukim. Okay, now essentially what we have in the third perek is Haman's rise to power. That's the first thing. The second theme in the third perek is Haman's personal infuriation with Mordechai. How he really gets upset with Mordechai and how the classic anti-Semite in him decides not only to do away with Mordechai, but to wipe out the entire nation of Israel to slake his anti-Semitism. The next theme, the third theme, is the quiet, silent political organization as to how to pass a law legalizing genocide, where King Ahasuerus is painted in a rather neutral manner, saying that, you know, he's not against the genocide of the Jews, but it's politically very unsavory to do so. And Haman has to come up with clear political reasons as to why it's perfectly acceptable to do away with these people, and you won't lose a thing by it. You don't need to worry about it at all. In fact, it'll even benefit you. And then quietly, without telling the entire populace, certain laws are enacted, such as ghettoisations and mass censuses and then rounding up and killing, that's done quietly or with the tacit allegiance of the provinces, such as the Baltic states and Lithuania and Latvia, who are only too happy to go and do it. That's actually how we're going. The machine of the Holocaust must now get set. And that's the third perek. The third perek is one, Haman's rise to power, his then fixation with the destruction of the Jews, and his political movement to try to get his wicked plan enacted through the tribunals that are available. Now, as he's doing it, he's setting up his own downfall at every step of the way. And this shows us God's hand throughout every element of the Megillah, right from the beginning, right from where Mordechai doesn't bow down to Haman, all the way through to Haman getting infuriated and casting lots, hence Pur, hence Purim, hence lots, what lot he picked, how God was involved there, and then how he sweet-talked to Ahasuerus, and that ended up actually being his doom. So that's essentially what's going to happen in the third perek, okay? That's the overview of the perek. Is everyone okay with that? Any questions? You're okay with that? Okay. Let's now have a look into the Medrash Rabbah, which is Esther Rabbah. And it's actually in Parsha Zayin, literally section 7 in the Medrash Rabbah, is where it deals with the third perek of the actual words that we're about to discuss. And it's Acha HaDevarim Ha'Ela, and after these things, Gidol HaMelech Ahasuerus is Haman ben Hamadasa HaAgagi. The Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, and elevated him. And the question is why, really the Medrash is asking, is why did God allow someone as wicked as Haman, and he really was thoroughly wicked, to enjoy such grandeur and prestige? That's what the Eitz Yosef describes as essentially the intro to this Medrash Rabbah. He says, the Medrash is puzzled by this pasuk that Ahasuerus is promoting Haman to such an extent. And says the Medrash as follows. It's all about events like these that you see in Psalms, in Tehillim 37:30, for the wicked will perish and the foes of Hashem are like the glory of fattened sheep. The foes of Hashem are like the glory of fattened sheep. That's key. What's going on? The answer is, says the Midrash, quoting this pasuk in Tehillim, that they're not fattened for their own good. It's not because we want to make lovely, healthy sheep that look very tanned and wonderful for Sheep Weekly, the wonderful publication, you know, for farmers or something like that, to have a blue ribbon sheep. This is a nice sheep. You're fattening them so that when you slaughter them, they taste nice. You're fattening them for your good, not their good. So too, Haman was promoted only as a prelude to his fall, because it gives God more honour to knock someone down that you've heard about than knock someone down that you've never heard about. If he knocks down, you know, Bill Thwaites of 22 Acacia Avenue, who you have no idea that he's a classic anti-Semite, you won't give God all that grandeur. But if he knocks down someone, like, I don't know, like Corbyn or Stalin or Hitler or someone like that, then you're like, wow, you see? He knocked out a really serious player. So God built him up, just so you recognise God's hand in it. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So there's another explanation. And Rabbi Levi is in the Gemara, in the Midrash. And he says, when the wicked bloom like grass and all the doers of iniquity blossom, that's Psalm 92:8. We say that on a regular basis. What's written at the end of the verse? It's to destroy them until eternity. We even say this for Kabbalah Shabbos. Haman was granted greatness only for his detriment. And why did God grant him that greatness? He says, Rabbi Levi says, you know what it's like? It's like a regular soldier who cursed the king's son. And the king said to himself, if I just kill him now, everyone will say, ach, you just killed a common foot soldier, a regular petty officer. It's nothing. No. So what am I going to do? I'm going to make him a very high-ranking lieutenant. I'm going to decorate him. And afterwards, I'll make him a governor. I'll make him like a general. And only after that am I going to kill him. So too, Hashem said to himself, as it were, if Haman were killed when he went down to advise Achashverosh to halt the building of the temple, which is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu was already very peeved with Haman, no one would have known about him. Rather, what I want to do is give him a lot of greatness, and then I'm going to have him hanged. And that's when it says that the enemies of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are granted greatness in order to anticipate their fall. That's why it says in Eiv 12:23, he exalts nations and then destroys them. Generally, not at the moment, but generally in our history, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's always built up a nation to very great grandeur and then used that nation to hit us in exile. Greece, Rome, Babylon, Chaldea, Egypt, etc. were all built up. In fact, Egypt was built up by the Jews in order to do this. That's comparable to a master that wants to chastise his slave, and instead of using a regular stick, he uses a golden scepter encrusted with jewels. That's to show his love for the slave. He's giving the honour of using a golden scepter, and then he'll beat him with it. At least he's saying, look, look what I'm beating you with, the very best. The very last exile you'll be in, that's not going to be the case. God will take a bunch of tent dwellers from the desert and he'll antagonize us with them, which would be considered the lowliest of nations. And that's what we see that's happening now. So at the final exile, we're not being given the due honor we've usually had in our exiles by being the spitz of Europe. The spitz of the world was Germany. Certainly in the 1920s, it was the most cultured civilization in the world. And that's what God used to chastise us with. Now, what we're being chastised with is not great cultures. And that, as it were, is a bazion for us, that we're not being, as it were, strapped with a golden strap, but with a very common twig. But generally, if you look at our history, he exalts nations and then destroys them. Or he'll exalt a nation, then use it to antagonize the Jews. It's very, very important. There is a story brought in the Medrash. I don't know if you can. I don't know if you can see this. I've got today a bit of a guest for the shiur. See this? Got a lion. So there's a story brought in the Medrash that a lion threw a party. This is a fantastic Medrash where Rabbi Pinchas, and Rabbi Pinchas said there was a lion that made a feast for all the behemoths and chayas, for all the domesticated animals and all the wild animals. And he made a beautiful big feast. And he spread over, he made like a canopy over all these animals of the skins of other lions, the skins of wolves, and the skins of all the vicious animals in the world, like leopards and tigers and things. And they sat underneath those skins. And other tigers and wolves were also invited. And they ate and they drank. And the animals all said to each other, if only someone would now sing a song for us. We've got to sing a song. You know, we're having a feast. And they all looked at the fox. Everyone turned around and they saw a fox sitting there. They go, you're good at this. You sing us a song. So the fox said, I'll sing you a song, but you've got to promise me that you'll respond after me. Whatever I say to you, you have to sing it as well. And all the animals said, okay, whatever you sing, we'll sing. So the fox said to them, he sang a song, and he said, he who has shown us what is above us, may he show us regarding those below us. And they all sung this. He who has shown us what's above us, again, regard us what's below us. And the Medrash says, the Rabbi Pinchas brings this as a moshel. And he says, there were Jews alive at the time of Shushan that understood what was starting to happen. And there were astute Jews that said, after the execution of Big Son and Seresh, he who showed us the downfall of Big Son and Seresh and their hanging, may he also show us the downfall of Haman, and he who punished the former ones, may he punish the latter ones. Just as in the story with the lion and the fox, all the vicious animals of the skins are above us are dead, may we see the lion and all the other dangerous animals that are below, alive and walking among us at the party, also dead. But the fox didn't actually dare say his wish explicitly, because at the end of the day, the lion was the host. You can't say sing about the death of the host at the party. What did he do? He used an illusion. It was very oblique, so that only the clever animals in his audience would understand. But he asked that everyone respond and say amen to his tefillah. So too, when we're reading the Megillah, we have to understand that the Jews actually did get the idea that Haman and Ahasuerus were really evil. But we can't say that outright in the Megillah. We can't just say that because Ahasuerus is going to read this Megillah. But anyone that reads this with any level of astute carefulness will see Ahasuerus kind of like Hitler and Haman a bit like Himmler. You know what I'm saying? They're very, very bad news for the Jews. So we see that God is building up these individuals just to knock them down. It's a really important point. So that is the intro to the third parak that the Medrash Rabbah gives. Okay? And with that in mind, let's delve in to the actual text, which is 3:1 in the Megillah. Acha hadvarim ha'ela. After these things, Gidl ha'melech ha'hashras ha'haman ben ha'madasa ha'gagi. Then what happened? He Gidal, he literally made great. He promoted Haman, the son of Hamadasa, the Agagite. Remember, Agagite comes all the way back to the king of Amalek, which Shaul left alive to be with a maiden that one night. We've never forgotten the root of the problem. We're being told again what the problem is, was Shaul's incorrect ability to be too kind to those he should have been cruel with. And he raised his status. Now look at this. V'yosem es kisayma al hasarim. He placed his seat above all the other ministers who were with him. He placed his seat higher. Now we're going to learn this means he physically actually changed Haman's seat to be on a platform so that he looked physically elevated from all the other individuals. This is a really, really important piece of information. So now, let's talk about if he felt indebted to Haman. We're going to talk about why. Why didn't he feel indebted to Mordechai? Let's have a talk about why he promoted Haman. This is the first theme of the third parak. Even though Mordechai had foiled the assassination attempt of Bigsan and Seresh, which, by the way, as we learnt, was Haman's idea. They went to him and he said that you should poison his drink, right? And nobody, you know, that didn't get back to Achashverosh. It was Haman's idea. And, oh, you know, Bigsan and Seresh, though, you know, they were killed. They moved out of the way. He attributed, Achashverosh attributed that savior as Esther herself. Because Esther was the one that said over in the Mordechai, oh, you know, Bigsan and Seresh are trying to kill you. So really, he felt as if he owed everything to Esther Hamalka. And when he thought about it, when Achashverosh thought about it, he thought, I'm very, very lucky I crowned her as queen, aren't I? Think about it. Had I not have crowned Esther as queen, I might have been killed by Bigsan and Seresh. I'm so lucky to have Esther. Rabbi Isai, who put Esther there in Achashverosh's mind? Why did Esther become queen? Answer was, it was Memuchan's idea, right? And who was Memuchan? Memuchan was Haman. He said, get rid of Vashti and get yourself an Esther, essentially. So Achashverosh thought, wow, am I only lucky I listened to Haman and got Vashti out of the way and supplanted her with Esther, and Esther saved my life. Psh, I'm so lucky. And it was only Memuchan, if you think about it, if you remember back in the second parak, all the other advisors, he had seven advisors, all the other advisors thought it was a very bad idea politically to get rid of Vashti. Only Haman wanted her out the way for his own reasons because he saw her as a dangerous player who might not go along with what he wants to do. So he got the king to execute her. Everyone else said, no, it's not a good idea. It was only Haman that wanted her out the way. And he says Achashverosh to himself, now that I've seen that all the other advisors who were greater than Haman and they didn't want me to kill Vashti, they were wrong, because now Vashti's been supplanted with Esther. She was the one that saved my life. So you know who the greatest advisor is? It's not the other guys. It's Haman. Really, Haman saved my life. That's how Achashverosh is thinking, not knowing that Achashverosh was the one that was actually in danger, because Haman was the one telling Bigsan and Seresh what to do. He didn't know that. So he thinks that Haman essentially is the one that's given him the wonderful gift of Esther. That's what it means after these things. After the things where he investigated Bigsan and Seresh, as we said last time, at the end of last time, he went and looked into it. Tuck, it's true. What Esther's saying is true. Bigsan and Seresh did want to kill me. And really, Haman's advice was the most beneficial thing, because if it wasn't for Haman putting Esther there, I'd have been killed. Now, the problem is that it was legally unlawful to suddenly promote one advisor above all the other most powerful ministers of the land. And they would protest. So Achashverosh promoted Haman in three stages. The Pasuk says first, King Achashverosh promoted Haman. That means he promoted him to a higher position than the original one he had. Then he raised his status. The Pasuk says, and then he raised his status over and above that new level. And only finally did he actually put his throne, as it were, on a platform and let him sin above the other advisors. So he did it in stages, but he really wanted, essentially, to give Haman all the glory right away. But he did it in a, you know, first of all, you give him a knighthood, and then you give him a peerage, then you make him a lord, then you make him chief justice. You don't just throw him into chief justice, you know what I'm saying? He did it in political stages, seemed like a natural elevation, but he wanted to give him a tremendous Akoros HaTov, because essentially he felt as if he'd saved his life. Now, he placed his seat above all the other ministers. He literally had a platform and he put his seat at a platform and all the other seats would be on an equal level. So Ahasuerus placed his chair on a high platform so that when the other ministers all sat in their chairs, it looked like Haman was literally above the other ministers. The only person who sat higher than Haman was Ahasuerus in the council. So all the other ministers had regular chairs. Then there was Haman, and then there was Ahasuerus, like at that kind of three-step system. So it looked like Haman was almost like the steward of the kingdom. Let's look at Pasuk base. Verse 2. For Chol Avdei HaMelech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech. This is really important now. This is the second theme coming in. So that's the first theme. The first theme is the promotion of Haman and why. The second theme is now setting the stage as to why Haman gets so annoyed with Mordechai. All the other king's servants at the king's gate, when they came in the morning, they had to bow, Kairim Umishtachavim. They had to bow and prostrate themselves to Haman because the king commanded such concerning him. Why do we need the words concerning him? Just say the king commanded. We're going to learn that. Those are very important words. But Mordechai didn't bow and he didn't prostrate. So bowing is just like bowing at the hip kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like a very elongated curtsy. Prostration means get on the floor and stretch out your arms and your legs. Like mummies, prostrate yourself. That's what all the ministers had to do to Haman. They had to literally bow down and then get on the floor and prostrate. Mordechai walked in. He didn't do any of it. He didn't even curtsy. Nothing. Now, everyone obviously naturally would have bowed to the greatest of all the royal ministers. And you don't need the king's command to do that. If you find the great minister in the kingdom, you're going to bow anyway. But the king commanded that his subjects not only bow to Haman, which is normal, but they should actually prostrate themselves on the ground to him by stretching out their hands and feet. To serve as some kind of hegemony to him. A very intense form of hegemony. That's why the verse said that the king commanded people to bow and prostrate themselves. And then only afterwards does it indicate that without the king's order, they would not have even bowed to Haman. But since it says that they bowed and they prostrated themselves, we understand that the king had commanded as specifically prostrating themselves to Haman. That was a royal decree that you had to bow down as normal and you had to go something extra for Haman. And that was to thank him, to pat him on the back for saving the king's life. Look, you saved my life. I'm going to give you a super honor. I'll elevate your position and I'll force the people, even the ministers, to bow down to you. Okay. Now, the famous Medrash Esther Rabbah 6:2 says that Haman was very sneaky. And he placed an image of idolatry on his garment somehow, whether it was a brooch or some kind of badge, I don't know. But it was clear that he had an idol that was hanging from either his neck or on his garment. I don't know, I guess it's like if it was the Archbishop of Canterbury and he's wearing a huge Salem around his neck. And then the Queen says everyone that passes him has to actually prostrate themselves. You are by proxy also prostrating yourselves to this image as well. And that's what Haman was doing, right? Why did he do that? He did that in order to be able to get people to bow down to this idol as well, especially Jews, causing them to sin. That was specifically his intent, because he knew the whole thing with Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, and the whole thing of bowing down to the idol, and Vashti being the third generation, etc., that was the root of Israel's sin, and he wanted to really capitulate and capitalize on that, and get people to keep doing it, so he'd have ostensibly power over the Jews as well. All right, let's look at verses 3 and 4 together as a group. V'yomru avdei hamelech. Now, these are the other servants talking to Mordechai. Excuse me, talking to Mordechai. The king's servants, who were at the king's gate, said to Mordechai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command? You come in here every morning, and you don't bow down to Haman, which is normal, and you don't keep the special command of prostrating yourself to him, as you should." Verse 4, "And it was when they said to him, day after day," every day he would come into work, he wouldn't bow down to Haman, and he wouldn't prostrate himself, and every day he did not listen to them. Every day they shepherded him. Here he comes. Bet you won't bow down today. And they told Haman. Why wouldn't they tell the king? At the end of the day, the person who he's really causing trouble with is the king. The king is the one that commanded that everyone should bow down to Haman. Why did they tell Haman? To see whether or not Mordechai's words would stand up for him. For he had told them that he was a Jew. What on earth does that even mean? What's going on here is that Mordechai told the king's servants that he was a Jew. And therefore, I can't bow down to idols, which is hanging or appended onto Haman's clothing. And they said, "Yeah, but your forefathers bowed down to Esav." Why? They knew their Chumash. Indeed they did. When Yaakov Avinu met with Esav, just when he was trying to avoid war, the Klal Yisrael did bow down to him. In fact, Yaakov Avinu prostrated himself 7 times to Esav before he finally embraced him. And he said as follows, listen to this, what did he say to them? "I'm from Shevet Benjamin. I'm from the clan of Benjamin. And if you remember, Benjamin didn't actually bow down to Esav ever. And because I'm from that particular clan, it's my heritage not to bow down to Edom. And Haman is an Agagite who is a descendant of Edom. So I don't do that." Now, Rabbi, can I just remind you? We say that essentially Judaism today is split up into Yehuda and Yisrael. Yisrael being everyone that goes through, that mainly means Benjamin. It was Benjamin and Yehuda that were loyal to the Davidic dynasty, and all the other 10 tribes got exiled earlier than them, and they got scattered in the world. But the two groups of Jews which stayed loyal to David were exiled later, and that was Shevet Benjamin and Shevet Yehuda. Today, we generally say that Ashkenazim are from Shevet Benjamin and Sephardim are from Shevet Yehuda, which strongly suggests that the Mashiach is most likely to be Sephardi. Okay? Now, this is very interesting because we're seeing that Shevet Benjamin, the clan of Benjamin, has a special koyach against Amalek. And that would seem to be the Ashkenazim. And when Mordechai, who was, as it were, of Benjamin, which would be more Ashkenazic, as it were, even though they're in Persia, notice that when Haman got really angry with the Jews, the most important clan he was after was Benjamin, because that was the home clan of Mordechai and the clan that didn't bow down to his ancestor. So when he wants to wipe out Mordechai's clan, he's looking to destroy the Ashkenazim. How interesting. When Amalek, who has a special weakness with Benjamin, wants to wipe out the Jews, the first group of Jews that they're going to hit are going to be the Ashkenazim. We're going to discuss that more in the next few psukim. That's interesting if you look at modern history. So, the servant said, "If you're a Jew, then why do you transgress? You're different from your forefathers who did bow down." He said, "No, I'm a Benjaminite, and therefore I don't have to do that. So now why did the servants go and tell Haman, and why didn't they just go and tattletale to the king? Probably got him killed. More than likely, he's transgressing the king's command. In fact, if Jews transgressed the king's command, they were so hated, we learned that in the first barrack, they were so hated if they touched a pot that the Persians were cooking on, that was it, they had to dump everything. If a Jew is transgressing the king's command, he's far more likely to be executed than anyone else. And indeed, we even found this out in Daniel. In Daniel 3:8, it says that Nebuchadnezzar, when he set up an idol, he commanded that every single nation must worship it. And the Chaldeans, who were the home nation of Nebuchadnezzar, went and told Nebuchadnezzar that some Jews weren't worshipping it. And it was them that he was saying, oh, then we'll definitely kill them. We're going to chuck them in a furnace. So that's interesting. But why was it that they didn't go and tell the king? The answer says, from the Al Shech HaKadosh, that the king's servants were jealous of Mordechai. Listen to this. It's really interesting. It's talking about kind of like a work relationship issue between Mordechai and the other ministers and counselors who worked in the palace. Every day they had to turn up to work and they had to bow and prostrate themselves to Haman, which it seems they didn't like to do. But Mordechai, the Jew, didn't do that. So how did they interpret that? They didn't so much interpret that as Mordechai having personal beef with Haman. They interpreted that Mordechai felt as if he was more lofty and grand than all the other ministers, and he was showing airs and graces above them, and they envied him, thinking he doesn't need to do that because he thinks he's greater than us. He should do like everybody else does. This is the law of the land. Do it. You're not greater than us. You're subject to the laws just like everybody else. So they said to each other, if we go and tell the king, he'll kill Mordechai. What good will that do for us? Their desire was solely in making Mordechai submit and prostrate himself before Haman, just like anyone else, so he would know he's no greater than them. They had personal reasons for telling Haman, not the king. They wanted to get Haman angry to force him to bow down so they wouldn't feel as if they're being belittled by Mordechai. That's why they told Haman. After all their chippering didn't work, they went and told Haman himself. And they hoped that they'd get Haman angry and that Haman would beat him or do something to force him to bow down, to knock the Jew into shape, to make him realise he's no better than anyone else in Parliament. He doesn't have any special status because of his lineage. Okay, but he turned around and said, but I'm telling you, I'm Jewish. I've got no personal slight to you. This is not a work relationship issue where I feel as if I should be a managing director and all you guys are just like standard workers. I don't feel as if I'm greater than you. I just have a personal issue which has got nothing between you and me, but it's everything between me and bowing down to people. I just can't do that. They didn't believe him. They thought, nah, you just are aggrandizing yourself over us. That's what it means. We'll see if his words stand up for him. We'll really see if what he's preaching about his lineage is protecting him, or actually he really feels as if he's just better than us. So it says in Esther Rubber 7:8 that when the king's servants asked Mordechai why he couldn't bow down, he said, I'm from Benjamin. I've got a special lineage. Now, they went and told Haman, and Haman didn't do anything about it. He didn't know anything about it. Look at verse 5. Vayera Haman, ki ein Mordechai kol mishtachav eloi. He saw firsthand every morning. He looked out for him and he saw Mordechai was, he was just walking into the office. Ooh. Then he got angry. Haman v'yumale Haman chema. Haman became filled with wrath. Rabbi, what do we learn out from this? What do we learn out from this? Very important. We learn out in the Torah in a couple of places, this being one of them, that when you hear about something, it doesn't have as much impact on you as when you actually see it. I probably have told you this before, and please forgive me if I've done this before, if I've given this over before, but I do remember Tony Blair at the Truth and Reconciliation of the Iraq inquiry as to why they went to war. They asked Tony Blair, look, this is ridiculous. You sent British soldiers to war to die in Iraq over claims that there were weapons of mass destruction, and years of looking for them have been utterly fruitless. It was all jazzed up, and you believed it, and you essentially killed our blessed service personnel. You have to answer for that. What was his response? He was nothing doing. He says, MI6, MI5, NSA, the National Security Association in America, the CIA, which is the MI6 of America, all told me that's what's going on. Because of course I'm going to believe it. What do you mean to do? I'm a prime minister. If everyone sits around the table saying we know, you know, Saddam Hussein has a bomb and he's going to use it possibly against England, of course I've got to go to war. The fact that when you go there, you find there's nothing, you know who you need to take this up with. You need to take it up with all the security services who lied to me or gave false information. They said, yeah, Tucker, you're right. They said, you're right. So they went and they called them and said, no, we can't answer any questions because of matters of national security. And that was it. And that was the end of it. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Full stop. We're not going to take into task for that. Now, it's interesting. Now, let's pretend you're Moses on Mount Sinai and you're getting the Torah from God himself. And God himself says to you, you better pick up those two tablets you got and go downstairs because the people you brought out of Egypt, i.e. the Erev Rav, who I've got nothing to do with, they've started to defile themselves. And he went, And he went downstairs. He went down the mountain. And what did he do when he saw the rabble dancing around an effigy? He smashed the luchos in fury. He goes, this is ridiculous. Now the question's as follows. If God himself is telling you what's happening downstairs, isn't that more important than the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, MI5, MI6, GCHQ, and everybody in the world? All put together, isn't God's word more reliable than that? Of course it is. Why didn't Moshe Rabbeinu pick up the luchos and just smash them on the ground right there? Answer is, hearing about something doesn't make the same impact as actually seeing it for yourself. Now, these ministers went and told Haman that Mordechai isn't bowing to you in the morning. It's not very good, is it? But when he went out to actually see and look at Mordechai walking with impudence in front of him and not bowing, that's when the whole thing got triggered. Because he saw it happen. And this is one of the sources that tells us that when you see something with your own eyes, it has a far more profound effect than hearing about something from someone else, even if that someone else is God himself telling you. Amazing. This also tells us about Haman as well and what a Balgaiver he was. It's very interesting. The wrath of the king's servants was not roused even though Mordechai wouldn't bow prostrate himself. That's interesting. That's why it says when Mordechai will neither bow nor prostrate himself. That indicates the servants expected him at least to do something. Either to bow or prostrate, but maybe he wouldn't do both. But Haman would only have been satisfied if Mordechai had both bowed and prostrated. The other servants are like, look, you've got to do something. You've at least got to curtsy so that you don't appear to be lording yourself over us, and then we're happy. Haman, you've got to go the whole way. Unless he bows and prostrates himself both in front of me, I'm livid. Even everyone else didn't feel quite that way. Mordechai didn't do either. He didn't bow and he didn't prostrate to Haman. And that really irked Haman. And he was so conceited that had Mordechai have done one of them, had he had bowed or prostrated, that also wouldn't have been enough. He wants total subjugation from the Jews and nothing less. unless he literally sees the Jews kissing his feet, he's absolutely livid with them. What did he do? He asked these ministers, why is it that he behaves with such insolence? So the minister said to him, in the first instance, it's because you're hanging this idol, or you've got this idol on your garment, and he as a Jew finds that, taboo. He can't bow down to that idol, and therefore he won't bow down to you. So, you know, he was only wearing the idol to get the Jews to sin, Mordechai as well. So what did he do? What did he do? It says in Esther Rabbah 6:2, he took the idol off. So it was obviously visible. It wasn't obviously just like a lapel badge, which was invisible. It was obviously some kind of visible, open symbol or image, which everyone could see, and he took it off. So one morning he took it off. Mordechai came in and he thought, you know what? Maybe Tucker, it's true, he's got a religious issue and I can't subjugate him to this idol, but at least me personally, he'll subjugate to. He took it off. What did Mordechai do? He didn't bow prostrate himself to Haman personally, even though he didn't have the idol on. Now it's personal. This is not a religious issue. This is between you and me. Now, he also took it off because at the end of the day, if it would have got to the king said, I only told you to bow down and prostrate yourself to Haman, but not to an idol. And had it have gone to court, Mordechai would have said, well, Haman had an idol on him and I'm Jewish and I can't do that. And he'd have got off. So in order to forestall that argument, Haman also took off the idol to make absolutely sure that Mordechai would have absolutely no excuse as to why he's not bowing down to Haman. He's posher just being illegal. He's not following the law of the land. Even without the icon, Mordechai wouldn't bow. Now, this is interesting. This is classic, classic Rishus. This is as wicked as it gets. It says, Haman was filled with wrath against Mordechai, Dafka. And what's going on? He said like this. In his heart, he said, right, I'm going to kill all the Jews. All the Jews, especially Shevet Binyamin. Because Mordechai is representative of that clan that won't bow down to Edom or Amalek. We've got to wipe them out. And while we're at it, we'll wipe out all the Jews. Mordechai isn't enough here. There's a scourge in the world called Jews, and we ought to wipe every last one of them out, which would of course include the real problematic Benjaminites. How interesting. How interesting. He's got to kill them all, which is why later when he cast lots, he was doing it for everybody. He was looking at the annihilation of every Jew. But that doesn't mean Mordechai. Mordechai he'll deal with earlier. I'm going to personally deal with Mordechai because he's the one that's caused this. But while I'm at it, I'll wipe out his entire nation. That is beyond reason. That doesn't make sense. If someone black insults you, do you get the feeling I've got to kill every African on earth? Chas v'shalom, you've got a personal problem with this guy. What difference does it make? An anti-Semite? You Jew are insulting me? It's all the Jews. Every Jew's got to go. So look at verse 6. V'yivez ba'enov. And he deemed it contemptible to cast his hand on Mordechai alone. That wouldn't slake his lust. For they had told him, that who was Mordechai's people. Mordechai keeps going on saying, I can't bow to you because I'm a Jew. That's the problem, right? Being Jewish is the problem. Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. Who are who? Mordechai's people. They're from Benjaminite. All Jews are like those Benjaminites. They won't bow to me. Who were throughout the entire kingdom of Ahasuerus. Suddenly the Holocaust has its inspiration. The best thing to do with all the Jews to offset any problem in future is just to kill them all. And then we'll never have a problem with them. So he had two stages in his plan that he's starting to hatch. First, he deemed it contemptible to cast his hand upon Mordechai alone. What does that mean? He wanted to kill everybody. He wanted to kill everybody. Because they recounted Mordechai's history, specifically that he was from Shevet Binyamin, and that he was even a descendant of Shaul, who had destroyed most of the Amalekites, but let his own ancestor live an extra day. It was a well-known fact, by the way, that Haman's wife was a great astrologer, and she said to Haman, if Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not succeed against him. And she said, if she's from the seed of the one before who you've begun to fall, i.e. Shaul, then definitely going to lose. So we do know, also we know from the Pesukim earlier that brought Mordechai's lineage, that it was no secret that Mordechai was a Benjaminite and that he was descended all the way from Shaul. It's interesting that the Benjaminites are generally, today, the Ashkenazim. First things first is wipe out the Ashkenazim. They're the main problem because they're the ones that have a special koyach against Amalek. So when Amalek rises to power, a scion of Edom, Amalek arises to power, their first hatred will be amongst Shevet Binyamin. And that they kill all the Jews, but the real issue is that all the Jews are like them. They've got a problem, they won't subjugate themselves to our scion, our family. So then it reached a stage where he wanted to kill every single Jew throughout the entire empire. It's got beyond being personal between him and Mordechai. He now has a vendetta against a nation. He needs to ethnically cleanse an entire nation. But he's not in charge. He's not in charge. Only Ahasuerus is in charge. So the verse repeats Mordechai's people, meaning that in a general sense, all Jews are to be considered Mordechai's people. They're all like him. And I want to destroy everyone who was even known as the people of Mordechai to wipe out the problem entirely. It's interesting. You can also, it's a very interesting idea that is brought by the Medrash. So it's a very, very interesting idea. Mordechai, who was sitting at the king's gate, told everyone that he had specific origins. He descended from Shaul. And because Binyamin was the youngest of Yaakov's sons, he was like the baby. Remember when the reason why Benjamin didn't bow down is because he was in utero. He was in utero. He wasn't yet born. Haman himself considered it beneath his dignity to have Mordechai as an adversary from a baby clan. The baby clan? Benjamin, the baby? Oh no, I'll wipe out all of them. Judah as well. So it was beneath his pride just to kill Mordechai and the Benjaminites, because they're only the little babies. Let's chop off their head as well. That's why the verse says that the Jews were Mordechai's people. They were all part of one complete people, where every single individual was responsible for his fellow. That's a Gemara in Shavuos, Daf Lamedtes. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh. All Jews are guarantors, one for the other. Which means that one Jew's sin had a ramification for all the Jewish people. And when the Jews sinned at the feast, he knew it would have ramifications for the entire Jews all around the earth. And maybe he could destroy them all now. And that's true that the actions of any Jew in any time, at any place, is spread amongst the collective like an insurance policy. So when he said it's to destroy, Haman had in mind only to destroy, not only that, but to murder and annihilate. He really wanted, but he didn't say that. What's very key is that any group that wants to wipe out the Jews or any other place won't use the full force of their propaganda openly outside their own clientele. They'll try to legitimize their view first in the populace, in the government, and in society, before they unleash the full viciousness of their original plan, which is just stun murder. So they'll legitimize it with all kinds of legal and social terms to say why this group is bad, and then they'll say everyone from that group is bad. Let's look at verse 7. In the first month, B'chodesh HaRishon, Hu Chodesh Nisan. Do I need the Megillah to tell me that the first month of the year is Nisan when I've got it in a pasuk in Shemois Yud Bei space? Do I need that to be written in scripture? In the first month, which is the month of Nisan? That's like saying in the first month, the month of January. What, like I don't know? What the just say January or just say the first month. Don't. In the 12th year of King Ahasuerus's reign, he cast a pur. That is a lot. Like, do I need to know that? Before Haman, lifnei Haman, miyom leyom mechodesh lechodesh shneimasu hu chodesh adar. From one day to the next, through every month until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Is this some kind of class on how to count months? What on earth is being revealed to us in the most almost childish psukim, you know, January, February, March, April, you know, 30 days has, you know, what do I need this for? So the Medrash Rabbah 7:11 says that this is the lot, this pur, relates to the next words before Haman. So you should read this a lot before Haman, meaning Haman was unknowingly drawing a lot for his own destruction. He wants to pick out a lot to destroy. Indeed, he was picking out a lot to destroy himself. Also, we need to look at the words Hu Chodesh Adar, which is the month of Adar at the end of the pasuk. The Torah already says this month Nisan shall be to you the beginning of all months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. That's Shemois Exodus 12:2. So what's going on? There's a Gemara in Tanis, Chaf Tes Omad Beis. That's 29b. That says, if someone is going to go to court with a Gentile, if you've got to go to court against a Gentile, try to organise the court case to be in the month of Nisan. Certainly avoid the first week of Av. That is not an auspicious time to go to court with a Gentile. Do everything you can to get it out of the first week of Av. Anything before Tisha B'Av is bad news to go to court. If you're going to court against a Gentile, try to organise it for the month of Nisan. And our rabbis tell us why. Because Nisan comes from the word Nisim. Miracles. Nisan is the month where God did massive, massive miracles for us. So let... just a minute. There we go. Okay. Look at what Haman's doing. In none other than the very month when God decided to redeem his people from Egypt with world-famous plagues and the splitting of the ocean. As Monty Python said, we're now Red Sea pedestrians, right? Everybody's heard of the Jews walking in the midst of an ocean. It's like, you wouldn't have made that up if it hadn't happened. It's like so extreme. We're talking 15 million people and 90 million head of cattle walked in a rainbow up north from their start point in a curve through the Sea of Reeds. And then all the Egyptian army got completely destroyed in one foul blow. And everybody heard about it. And all the water split over all the world. In that month, you've decided you're going to destroy God's people. That doesn't seem to make sense. It's that very month where God is going to save his people with a miracle. That's why it says, that is the lot. Haman drew a lot for all days and all months to try to figure out which day would be the most brilliant day. Interesting, Amalek always work on statistics and nature. He drew a lot. The best thing he could do is leave it to chance, because Amalekites don't believe that God has his hand in daily events in the world. So make a lottery. Just to prove the point, you can destroy the Jews whenever chance says you can. Jews say there's no such thing as chance. And the very day he picked would be the worst day. That month of Nisan, that is the lot which was cast before Haman, not before Israel, because Haman was going to meet his own downfall in that month. And indeed, less than 4 days passed after Haman drew the lots that he was hanged in that month of Nisan. Remember the fast, the Tarnis was in Nisan, it was over Pesach. Which is why we can't keep the fast Tarnis Esther when it was actually meant to be, because that means we couldn't eat first night Seder. The scribes were called in, we'll see later in verse 12, on the 13th of Nisan. And that was followed by a 3-day fast called by Mordechai and Esther, which included the first day of Pesach, nullifying the eating of matzah. And Haman was hanged on the 17th of Nisan, and he drew a lot for the day and month of the year, not realizing that he was actually deciding Nisan that he should be hanged in. Going back to that Gemara in Megillah that we always discuss, 12b and 13b. It's always about there that so much is happening with Rishon Bar Yochai and the Talmidim. It says that Haman chose the month of Adar because specifically, as we said, that's why Eliyahu Hanavi jumped in to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, look, you've got to get involved here because it was the month that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. And whoever told Haman of Moshe's passing in Adar also told him that the very same date, the 7th of Adar, Moshe was born. So those dates are identical because the years of the righteous are generally perfectly complete. A very righteous individual dies on the same day he's born, on his birthday, so that the whole year is complete for him. That's why it says in Shemais, by the way, Exodus 23:26, I shall complete the number of your days. I.e., if you're said to die in a particular year, you'll die at the end of that full year, which for you is your birthday. Haman thought that any bracha gained by Moshe's birth, whatever day it was nullified by him dying on it. And he didn't know that Moshe Rabbeinu has a super special power and that Adar is linked to him. And that's the meaning of the end of the verse where we said, Hu Chodesh Adar, this is the special koyach of Moshe Rabbeinu. That month of Adar remains as it always was, the tremendous bracha of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that is, the lot before Haman means that it was before Haman, not before God. God didn't take part in Haman's calculations. He's not going to forsake his people. What we're going to do, Be'ezus Hashem, next time, is verses 8, which is a very important verse, 9, 10, 11, and 12, hopefully. Now, verse 8, I've actually marked in my sefer with a note called Implementation of the Final Solution. In verse 8, we see how any political body, whoever they are, should go about trying to persuade the establishment to go ahead with mass genocide. And if you look at verse 8 carefully, there are 5 separate political problems about ethnic cleansing which all need to be addressed before you go and do it. So today, there's probably ethnic cleansing going on in China. And just a few years ago, in Serbia and Yugoslavia and all those areas, there were the Serbs and going around killing each other. Ethnic cleansing is not a new thing. It's a relatively common thing. But before a government decides to wipe out a people by genocide, there are certain political maneuvers that have to be put into place. Before the Nazis destroyed the Jews, they had certain things put in place to make it more acceptable and palatable to do that. Verse 8 is an absolute history lesson to see exactly how that works. And Haman approached Ahasuerus and quelled all of his fears about destroying the Jews. And then in the next verses, he's actually going to mint coins and give and pay Ahasuerus for the right to kill the Jews legally. So this is where it all starts heating up under the table, where policy is written secretly to murder every single Jew. And that's verses 8 through essentially 11. And then we're going to see how his very policy is what undoes him. And I look forward to doing that with you next time. So remember, let's do the themes here that we've done so far. One is, Haman had to get promoted to a high status so he can knock him off his perch and make a bigger Kiddush Hashem. Two, Haman has to get infuriated with a Jew and then decide that all Jews have to pay the price for infuriating him. And three, Haman is going to now start to choose a date to put into motion his evil plan. And now what verse 9 is going to tell us about is how he's going to present that plan to the powers that be to make it seem political. He was a very smooth political operator. Remember, he did get Vashti killed. He knows how to move about. And at the end of the day, he has ostensibly got himself up on the highest throne in the kingdom next to Ahasuerus's. And everyone's bowing down. It seems it's going very well for him. He's well placed to put this policy as an act before government and get it signed into law. So we're going to see how that's going to develop in the next Pesukim and all the little tricks that he puts in, which actually end up causing his own downfall. Every single thing he does actually trips him up, which again is all Hashgacha Pratis. It's unbelievable, you know. God's there every step of the way going, oh, you want to do that? Oh, we'll see how that works out for you. Right? So that's going to be really, really interesting. And I look forward to carrying on into those Pesukim. And please, God, there's not that much more to the third parak. I hope even within the next session or the session after to finish the third parak entirely and get on to the fourth parak. It's quite a short parak. I look forward to doing that with you.